Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Every month or so, we talk automotive maintenance and repair, and we welcome Gordon Fricke. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls, New York. He has been in the automotive repair and service industry for over 30 years. He knows his stuff. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Also, you could email us, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. Or tweet us at WAMCVoxPop or go to Facebook, facebook.com/WAMCRadio. But once again, the phone number is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, a lovely day for a drive today, huh?
Very nice day today.
Boy, it was really... This is, to me, driving weather.
Oh, it's perfect. I was tempted to ride my motorcycle, but I thought maybe the traffic wouldn't be much fun.
And that's a good plan. It's always good to plan that ahead. And this one came in via email before the show started from Paul in North Adams, who wanted to call but is at work. Hmm. So, all right, Paul, your secret is safe with us. You're blowing off work and listening to the radio. That's fine. Here's the question. Air conditioner is not blowing cold air. I'm pretty sure I hear the compressor come on when I push the AC switch, but it just blows outside air temperature. Is it effective to use the recharging kits, and how much should I expect to pay? Also, do I need to use a pressure gauge if I do that? That's from Paul in North Adams.
Yeah, that's a good question. You're finding these recharge kits available again, where for a while they were pretty much non-existent when they phased out R12 Freon and brought in the R134A.
Yeah.
Freon became a big problem with the ozone layer and all that. So now you're getting R134A kits to the do-it-yourselfers. And it's a roundabout way of, if your air conditioning system has lost some refrigerant, maybe a pound or so, you can replenish it. And the good kits do come with a little gauge on the can, so you watch the pressures. And you allow the refrigerant into the system. And when you're at the pressure, it's pretty broad. It just gives you, I think, a green range that means you're okay. In that case, those things do work. So if you're going to do it, get the kit with the gauge, follow the instructions.
And be careful when you do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not super, super dangerous. But, yes, it's a pressurized container that you're dealing with the refrigerant. And if the refrigerant... Let's say the hose, you tear the hose, you cut it by mistake, and that refrigerant sprays out full blast. It can freeze things. And if you get it in your eye, you're in major, major trouble. So yes, absolutely. But aside from that, it then will require some professional testing with real gauges and real diagnostics.
Okay.
But he's on the right track.
Yeah, I've done that a couple of times, and the kits do work.
Yeah.
Some cars are more difficult than others, as I've pointed out in the past. I had 99 DeVille, couple 99 DeVilles, and the computer, once it sensed there was a low level, shut down the compressor.
Yes.
So you had to go in, clear the code, fool the compressor.
Yes.
And then get the air conditioner to suck in the new R134.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, Paul, thank you for that email. Hope that's helpful. Our number here is 800-348-2551, and let's start with the phones. And Rich in Troy is first. Rich.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'd like to say hi to Pat at Gas Menagerie in Troy. And my question is, I've got an 06 Outback wagon that has, I think, 78,000 miles on it now. It's when I got it at 40,000 through now, it's got what seems like classic hesitation, like a carbureted car. I've had it to the dealer, and they've looked for any codes in the computer. There's no check engine light on the dashboard. We've looked at the it's got new plugs and wires. We've looked at the mass airflow sensor, which is clean. I cleaned it off with some carb fluid very carefully. And I just wonder if you can advise me of what to start with to try to fix this.
Sure. Rich, does this hesitation occur in all speeds or only when you're in drive steady cruise, let's say at 55 miles per hour, for example?
No, it's most obvious from sitting still.
Oh, it's
and it's worse the more you, the harder you press on the gas pedal from a standing start.
So what does the car do? Does it lurch or you know, give you some feedback that it's not accelerating? Yeah.
It bogs out. It acts like it's about to stall, and then it gives a couple of coughing sputs, and then goes. And the if you're chill with the throttle starting up, it doesn't show much symptoms at all.
Hmm. And is it worse if it's first cold start of the day accelerating, or fully warmed up? Doesn't matter.
Doesn't seem to matter.
Okay. Well, when there's no codes and no known trouble, I always suspect fuel buildup. And we talk about this a lot on the show, we get a lot of calls for various things. And I always recommend one or two doses of a product called Tecron. And it goes in the gas tank, and you can buy it in, I think, 12 or 20-ounce bottles.
What's it called again?
Tecron. It's made by Chevron.
I think one is for 8 gallon or 12 gallons.
Yeah.
One is for more than that.
One is a more powerful dose, and it treats more gallons. And you can overdose the car, but I think if we're trying to solve a problem when we're suspicious.
What's it called again? Tecron. It's made by Chevron.
Tecron.
Yeah. You got it?
Yeah. Okay.
Hello?
Oh, okay. Okay. I think we're going to have to hang up there.
Sounded like a little transfer of information there.
I think that was actually us.
Oh. Is it the new studio?
I think he had the radio on and he was listening. And I think that'll do. So thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. I know that stuff does work. And
I'm
overdue on the van.
I just put a bottle in my wife's car the other day.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
All right. Let's go to Howard in Amherst, Mass. Howard.
Yes. I have a 2011 Subaru Outback. It's got about 50,000 miles on it. And I'm going to be driving across country. And the battery is a little weak. And I want to know, should I change that battery now? Because if I'm driving on the highway and the battery should fail, would the car stall?
Yeah. How many miles did you say?
About 50, 51, 52.
Okay. It's an 11 car. It may have been produced sometime in 2010.
It's a five-year-old battery.
Yeah. Yep.
I bought it in April of 2011. So it's 5 years old.
When you say
and
it's getting
winter,
weak,
you know, cold nights, it would crank very slowly.
Okay.
And I didn't know if this is the type of car that when the battery fails, the car stalls. I once had a Volvo and the battery failed and the car quit.
Yeah. If the battery won't just completely fail to pieces while you're driving, but if it rapidly deteriorates, you're going to continue to run and drive, but the next time you go to start the engine, it may not start. So I think...
Right, well, that would be okay, but if I don't want to be driving down the freeway like my Volvo all those years ago and things just quit.
This is what I would do. I would get it tested, but plan on replacing it because the battery's 5 years old going on six.
Yeah.
Some batteries last longer. I've seen cars come in with 7, 8, 9, sometimes 10-year-old battery, which is very rare. But if you are traveling and you don't want to be fooling around getting stranded or needing a jump start or things like that, test it, and it'll probably at the very least be marginal. And I think for peace of mind at this stage of the car's life, I would treat it to a battery and enjoy the trip.
Okay.
Thanks, Howard. We appreciate the call. Over to, is it Ina in Woodridge?
Yes.
You're on.
Okay, I have a problem with my air conditioner, too.
Okay.
But I believe the compressor's going on, but every time you turn on the cooling system, without touching the air conditioning button, it comes on and starts blinking. If you turn on the heating system, it does the same thing.
Yeah. Some vehicles, yours included, if the refrigerant level is too low, and you attempt to turn on the air conditioner or your defroster, which also calls the air conditioning system on, that light will flash. And that means you have trouble with the air conditioner. It's like the check air conditioner warning. And it's probably low refrigerant charge. And the question...
you're saying it should be recharged.
Well, that's what I'm thinking might be... What's going on there?
My son-in-law already checked that out.
Oh, okay, so it's something else.
If the if the pressures are normal, meaning your refrigerant charge is where it should be, then there's fault elsewhere in the system, and it's got to be diagnosed. That won't blink you fault codes. It'll lead you to any direction.
Say that again?
You'll need to get it in and get the system diagnosed.
So if that is blinking, you will not be able to pull a code?
No, you won't get, on her vehicle, you won't get, that won't flash out codes for her.
Right.
Yeah, it'll just indicate that the system's down.
So you better have that taken.
Yeah, it's going to have to go in and get diagnosed. And it may not be anything too horrible, but you need to find out.
Yeah, well, they're saying it's the compressor.
Oh, boy.
Well, that's kind of, that can be a little expensive.
I just kind of found that hard to believe because that light blinks when you turn on the heating system.
Well, the heating system also calls the compressor on at various times. So that's why you're getting that light. If you have it on defrost, for example, the compressor is asked to come on.
Okay.
The heating system works fine, that'll tell you.
Yep.
Okay. Well, Ina, good luck with that. We appreciate it. We got to take a break here. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number, and we'll be right back.
Support for WAMT comes from Unusual Wedding Rings and More, 137 North Street, downtown Pittsfield, announcing their retirement on August 1st, providing traditional and non-traditional engagement, wedding, and anniversary rings for conventional and same-sex couples. UnusualWeddingRings.com. Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years. BoydenAndPerrin.com. Nine Pin Cider Works, serving New York hard ciders made from locally sourced apples. Tasting room open Wednesday through Sunday at 929 Broadway, downtown Albany. Be revolutionary, consider the apple. NinePinCider.com. Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. AGStewardship.org. And Northshire Bookstore, presenting John Lawton, author of The Unfortunate Englishman, on April 23rd at 7 p.m. in Manchester, Vermont. Northshire.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Gordon Fricke is our guest. We talk automotive maintenance and repairs every month or so, and we'll do a couple of emails here, Gordon, before we get back to the phones. This one's from Joel. It says, gentlemen, we heard a GM commercial recently advertising the fact that the car radio on at least one of their new models would be muted until a seatbelt was fastened. How can this feature be considered beneficial? Is this feature capable of circumvention? And if Big Brother has mandated this feature to force seatbelt usage, one might suggest that they have overstepped their authority.
Wow.
Comment if you will, Gordon.
Interesting, because I have taken note of that commercial.
Yeah.
And it's they're leaning towards young people.
Okay.
Getting into these cars. But I have found that the younger they are, the more prone they are to using their seatbelt.
Absolutely.
Because kids of my generation grew up in car seats, and they buckled up all the time, and they do currently, where my generation, we never wore seatbelts.
Oh, my gosh. And remember when those rules were mandated, and there were so many of us, it took a while to get used to using a seatbelt.
Yeah, it took a little impact on my part to start using my seatbelt on a regular basis when I was about 18 years old. But, that's interesting. And he is, the emailer is indicating, why should GM or anybody tell us when to buckle up or you don't get the radio? But I have a feeling that could be programmed
pretty easily. I bet you. There are a lot of things. Like, I know on some of, I think one of our cars, if you hit 20 miles an hour, the locks automatically engage.
Oh, that drives me nuts.
And you can get around that in a menu setting, but why bother?
Yeah, you got to go in the owner's manual and struggle through it, because the technical writers sometimes aren't really, on the right wavelength. But you can move a lot of that stuff around by yourself.
All right, this one is from Steven in Middletown. I have a 2012 Fiat 500. When it's cold, below 35 Fahrenheit, first thing in the morning when I start the car, a cloud of blue smoke comes out of the exhaust. I assume this means that oil has gotten in the cylinders overnight. This doesn't happen when the weather is warmer. Why would oil get in the cylinders when it's cold but not when it's warm?
Well, the question there is if it really truly is blue smoke, because he's correct. Blue smoke indicates oil.
Yeah.
Black smoke indicates too much gasoline, overly rich, and white smoke is coolant or water.
And that's a bad one.
Yeah, yeah. You've been there before, haven't you?
Oh, yes.
So if the car sits overnight, there was a time years ago when a lot of valve guide seals were getting weak, and they would let oil drip down the valve and it would get into the cylinder and burn up the first start of the day.
Yeah.
If that's happening to that Fiat, it's pretty extensive repair. If he finds he's not consuming much of any oil, and today's cars are consuming oil at a rate of about a quart or so to every 1,000 to 1,500 miles,
yeah,
which is being considered normal.
Right.
So I think I would just keep an eye on it and check his oil and not be worried at the moment.
Okay. Now, if in fact it was a little leak of oil internally,
yeah,
is that any of that valve, or not valve, but the leak stopper stuff worth doing, or is that too dangerous?
I don't think that's going to help this situation, but there are things you can pour in the oil that tends to soften up older seals, but that car isn't that old, is it?
2012, I think.
Yeah, and so I don't doubt he's got giant mileage on it, but he could have.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't think I'd put any additives in it yet.
All right, last email, and then back to the phones. This is from Michael. I have a 2007 Ford Focus. Could Gordon explain the procedure for diagnosing a sticking front disc brake caliper? Also, is there anything to keep in mind when bleeding the brake fluid after I replace the caliper? That's from Michael.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, to check for sticking brake calipers, wheels off the ground, so it's cars on a jack stand or lift or something, and have somebody in the car depressing the brake pedal. He's on the tire trying to turn it. He tells his helper to release the brake pedal, and then he sees how freely the tire can be turned by hand. And you can do all of them. And they should release almost the moment your helper takes his foot off the brake pedal. And if any of those wheels are providing too much drag, and there's where you've got to have a little bit of feel for it.
Yeah.
But if let's say one wheel is much harder to turn than the rest of them, that could be your suspect. But doesn't necessarily mean it's the caliper. The brake pads could be stuck in their mounts by rust.
Yeah.
Or the brake hose could be internally clogged.
Okay, so.
So there's a little bit more to it, but that's the test.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. And Laura in Shelburne Falls. Laura, you're on.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a 1997 Jeep Sahara, and my problem is it went from getting almost 20 miles per gallon down to 10. Now, we only drive this car in the summertime, like a couple thousand miles a year.
Hmm.
So last year, this began. And the one other aspect is when we take a corner, when the gas gauge only reads about a quarter of a tank, the Jeep sometimes like bucks almost as if it's running out of gas, but it's not.
Well, how many?
And we'd like to fix it, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions for what we can start looking into without spending $1 million.
Yeah.
How many miles are on the Jeep?
About 195.
Wow, it's got some miles on it. They're good.
Yep.
They're a good durable vehicle. They do last a long time, but
definitely
at that mileage, there's a lot of things that could be ganging up on this thing and giving you the poor economy. Is the check engine light on?
No.
Okay, so we can't scan it or look for any trouble there. Basics: condition of spark plugs, condition of air filter, condition of fuel filter.
All that stuff, with the exception of the fuel filter, was replaced the year before.
Okay.
Because I've started sort of like working on the vehicle myself, so I try to do things that are like,
yep,
you know, easy enough that I can handle, but not the gas filter.
Yeah. And that's just all routine maintenance items. But years ago with carburetors, if your air filter was clogging, you would get horrendous gas mileage because it was making more gasoline get pulled in. With fuel-injected vehicles, it's not so as it was back then, but vehicles that get stored for the winter, and sometimes I've even seen this if vehicles sit a weekend, mice can build a nest in your air filter,
oh boy,
plug up your air filter, and it'll happen so fast you won't know it. So I think it would be wise to take the air filter out, look at it,
okay,
make sure there's not a mouse nest on the other end of it,
okay,
and make sure the air filter is perfect. And if it isn't, replace it. And let's get a bottle of our trusty Tekron in the tank, see if there's any deposits that have built up on the valves and stuff like that.
Yeah, we usually, at the beginning of the season, I always put a fuel injector cleaner in. So it's kind of like done, and fuel filter. So it's sort of like, we've tried like sort of like the basic things.
Yep.
I mean, should we just accept that this is the way the Jeep is going to run from now on?
Well, if you don't want to go crazy and it runs fine, then if you're okay with it, yeah. But tire pressures, sticking brakes, a lot of things affect fuel economy. So I think it would be wise to just to give it a good once-over.
Okay.
Laura, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Abe in Irving, Mass. Abe, you're on.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I've got a 94 Ford Ranger. It's my son's truck, actually. And it's revving really high as you're going down the road. It's a manual transmission. When you depress the clutch, you could be doing 50, you could be 20. When you're going to switch gears, it wants to rev way up to 4 or 5 grand. Of course, it comes back down when you engage the clutch and it's with the motor. I replaced the IAC valve. I looked into the throttle body and it looks brand new. And I'm just about to bring it to the shop. I was just wondering if you can tell me what I can expect these guys to tell me.
Is that a V6 engine or a 4-cylinder?
It's a 4.
4-cylinder, okay. You've checked a lot of the normal things. The throttle plate and its linkage can get corroded and get sticky. And it was more of an issue on V6s of that era because they had like a little double jointed mechanism in there on the throttle body where your cable hooks up. And that mm-hmm. would get corroded. And if the driver was not putting it to the floor very often or hard throttle and then decided to do that one day, maybe to accelerate faster, pass a car, that linkage that never got used much got stuck from the rust.
Ah.
But the 4-cylinder, I'm not sure if it has that, but definitely look at it. And I think you're going to find there's a plastic cover over that where the throttle cable connects. So get under that. Take that off and look and make sure everything is smooth from zero throttle to full throttle, and then watch for to see if anything is sticking and holding that plate open. Other than that, vacuum leaks, air leaks around the throttle body and throttle plate is a suspicious area. But that's what I would do to start with.
Okay. All right. I'll keep that in mind, and thank you very much.
Abe, thank you very much. Over to Linda in Cornwall, New York. Linda, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, thank you. I have a 2007 Volvo Cross Country 70, and the gas tank doesn't fill up past half a tank. The gas will actually start coming out.
Huh. So your gauge, do you think you're able to get a full tank of gas in it, but your gauge stops reading at the halfway point? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's more than 12 gallons, it says in the owner's manual, and that's all I'm getting in, mm-hmm. and that reads as half a tank.
Okay, so you're pretty sure you're filling the tank, but the gauge is only reading half.
Ah.
Is that the case?
Well, I'm pretty sure that it's really only filling half or a little more than half because it's supposed to hold more than 12 gallons.
Oh, okay, yep.
Yeah.
If you were to coax the gas nozzle easier, can you keep putting fuel in it? Is it that
nope.
So it kind of runs out the top like it's dead full?
Yep.
Okay. Well, I without totally knowing if the gas tank is accepting a full tank, you'd have to pretty much run it out close to empty and then see how many gallons goes in it. And then you'd be 100% sure that the tank is in fact full and your gauge is only reading part full. So,
well, I do run it down to the red, and then I try to fill it again.
Yeah. It's very possible that the sending unit in the gas tank is not reading correctly. And there's a float in there that sweeps up on a potentiometer that changes the signal to the gas gauge inside the car on your dashboard. And it's possible that that thing is sticking at around half. So you may be, in fact, dead full and don't know it. And the only way to find out is to take it into a shop and investigate that sending unit, which would, on a Volvo, it's not that terrible. There's an access hole in the floor, and, you know, they want to make sure that the unit is giving it a full sweep and indicating the correct reading on the gauge. So it's going to take a little diagnostics, but that's what's going to have to happen.
Okay, because I had the lines checked, and nothing was blocking them, you know, to see if there was any debris or anything, and there wasn't. And I believe the filter or something within the line was clean, too. So
how big is the gas tank in that thing? How many gallons?
I want to say it was like 19 or something, 20.
Wow, it could be. That's a large capacity today, but...
So the odds are it's not something filling that tank that's not gas, right? It's a reading issue and not actually something in the tank that is preventing her from putting the full 20 in.
That's what I'm thinking, but it's going to require...
Well, what else could it be?
I would want to be sure that it isn't, in fact, really full.
No, I get it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if in fact it wasn't the reading, could there be some sediment, gallons and gallons of sediment at the bottom of this tank?
No.
Or is there some type of bladder or anything in there that would be expanding?
No, there isn't. No, there's nothing inside.
So
there.
It's most likely, I guess what Gordon is suggesting is get it down to as close to zero as you can and then see if you can put a full 19 or 20 in.
What you can
I've
do.
I've never been able to. I get it down to where, there's 20 miles left, you know.
But the thing of it is,
it's way in the red.
But you don't know if way in the red is not really in the red.
Oh, because the gauge is off.
Reading wrong. So
here's what you should do. Get a small gas can, like a 2-gallon can that's for like emergencies.
Yep.
Fill it up, carry it in the back of the car, and run it out of gas.
don't do it at night on the highway.
Yeah, I mean that's. But yeah, really be careful of or set your tripometer.
Uh huh.
And I don't know how many miles you normally would get out of a gas tank full on that car, but it's probably quite a bit if it is that big of a tank. But I would want to be sure that you're really out of gas.
Yeah.
And then put enough in to get to a station and see how much it takes. And if it takes 18 or 20, whatever the manual says the capacity of the tank is.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're getting the right amount, and you've got a gauge issue.
So how much would the gauge be to replace? Is it worth it just to have Linda sort of figure out what's full and what's empty and go with it as is?
Well, a lot of people would do that with a gas gauge that would just completely fail and go by the odometer and say, find out, okay, I usually get 280 miles out of a full tank, so when I get to 250, I'm going to start being careful and get gas,
Yeah.
So
you'll have to call us back on this one, Linda. Let us know how you did.
I'm a little perplexed.
Yeah, you got to go run out of gas.
Used this way, so.
All right. Well, good luck.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. Have a good day.
You too.
Yep.
800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Vox Pop. Ray Graff here. We're joined by Gordon Fricke here. He is our automotive expert. Always fun to have Gordon on the program. Tom in Pequog. Tom, you're on.
Greetings. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions related to tires, two different vehicles. The first one is a 2010 VW Jetta TDI, and it's got the TPMS, the tire pressure management system.
Okay.
And we frequently get the warning that the tire pressure's off. And I found on one occasion, after checking all the tires, I checked the spare, filled the spare, and that made the warning go out. And it's got me wondering if those things are coded to my car or not. And if not, would it be possible that I could pull up at a red light next to a car that's got low tire pressure?
Huh.
And could that other vehicle be signaling my car that there's an error in tire pressure?
I love this.
That's a really good question.
Yeah, great.
So here's the way these work. Now, your car being a 2010, I think that was the last year that Volkswagen, in most of the vehicles, used the radio frequency pressure sensors in each wheel. They went in 11, most of them went to a different system that monitored the wheel speeds and used a formula as to thinking if a tire was low or not. But anyway, if you have sensors in the wheels, and if does your spare really have a sensor in it? Is it a full-size spare?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
I think it must.
Is it a full spare or one of those skinny, tall, temporary spares?
Full spare.
It is a full. Okay. Each of those sensors gets has to be introduced to the computer. They call it a learning process. So the vehicle reads only its sensors, not the guy next to you.
So it's encoded with a multi-digit sort of a subtone?
So if I took the sensor out of your car, Ray, and put it in my wheel and vice versa, both of our low tire lights would come on because they'd say we got an unlearned sensor in our system.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah.
So therefore, that great question.
Yeah, but really good. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Tom. We appreciate it.
Okay, and now I have another one. It's a 2005 Toyota Sienna minivan.
Can you hang on the line? Because we have to take a break here, but I will get to your second part of your question in a moment.
Sure.
All right, hang in there. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Vox Pop. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMT comes from the Whistling Kettle, Troy, and Boston Spa, featuring over 150 teas and new specialty tea cocktails with the Blood Orange Sangria, thewhistlingkettle.com. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking, rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. George Propane, Goshen, Massachusetts, family owned and operated for over 75 years, serving Western Massachusetts with propane and full-service heating and plumbing, installation, services, and deliveries, georgepropane.com. The Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting the Pine Bush Explorer Series, April 25th through 30th, featuring guided walks from different trailheads in the 3,200-acre preserve, albanypinebush.org. And Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, specializing in extra-sharp New York cheddar since 1923. Offering imported and domestic specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, and more, waterwheelvillage.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. We're welcoming Gordon Fricke once again to answer your automotive questions. And where we last left the program, Tom in Pokwag was asking part two of his two-part question. Tom, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. So part two is I've got a 2005 Toyota Sienna minivan. The tires are pretty bald now. It's time to buy new ones. And being that they're run flats are being, I'm getting quoted $800 for a set of four. Meanwhile, I can get a set of four regular tires for like $300. I'm wondering is it okay to put regular tires on those run flat rims? Instead of the run flat.
Yeah, that's a good question because that whole run flat thing became very kind of sudden, especially with the van you're owning now. And when it became tire time, people were absolutely shocked. It was even more money for those tires back in 05, 06, 07, you know, in those years. But yes, you can put non-run flat tires on those wheels and they'll work perfectly fine. You can get a spare tire kit for that van, but it's very expensive. Or you can...
AAA.
Yeah, exactly. And carry a couple of cans of inflatable, you know, fix-a-flat.
Yeah.
So those are the options, and a lot of people do it because some cars, it's so expensive to put run flats back on, it's prohibitive. So you can do it.
Tom, thanks a lot. We appreciate you holding. 800-348-2551. By the way, I've got an email from Bob C., regarding the automatically locking doors. Ray, why does Gordon dislike the feature? Why does it drive him crazy?
I don't know. Maybe it's because I want to be in control of my vehicle.
You want to be free, man. Yeah, you want to be free.
If I want those locks locked, I'm going to lock them.
I kind of like the feature, frankly, because I often forget.
You know, it's not a bad idea because, you know, we live in a pretty rural areas, but I think with a security standpoint in a metropolitan area, it's nice to have all the doors locked.
Do you think that's why they do that?
I have a feeling. I don't know. Why else would they do it?
Maybe child safety?
Well, that could be, but
I can't see that they would do that for that reason. For sociological reasons, like
stop and go traffic in the city, carjackings and stuff, you know.
But oftentimes, if you're in a big city, you don't go over 20 miles an hour, and they don't even engage.
Well, that's true. Yeah, but
all right. Well, that's a great question. We'll pick that up another time. Let's go to Diane in New Salem. Diane.
Sir Ray.
Hello.
Hello, Gordon. I have a question about my 2010 Subaru Forester.
All right.
It has 22,000 miles on it. I've done nothing but oil changes and wiper blade replacements. Lately, I've been noticing I get a slight tremolo or vibration under my foot when I'm slowing down and putting the brakes on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very common. Brakes.
Is it because I just wanted to tell you that the brake fluid level is okay.
Yeah. Brakes can need attention in ways or for reasons other than being worn out. We see a lot of rust getting on the braking surfaces, on the brake discs, which is almost unavoidable.
Given it's 6 years old. And
yes. Yeah, that's very low mileage for a 2010 car. So that means it sits quite a bit. And I wouldn't be surprised if you were getting considerable rust built up on your brake rotor surfaces. And if you look through your wheels, depending on what you have, does your car have alloy wheels with big spokes where you can see the brakes? It does? Okay. If you look through those spokes, you'll see the brake disc.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're seeing that that's not all beautiful and shiny and it's starting to get orange and rusty, the rotors are getting rusty. And looking from the inside of the wheel out, which you can't do really unless you lie under the car with a flashlight, but the insides are always worse than the outsides because there's more salt and road grime and debris in there. So if you feel that your stopping distances aren't what they used to be and that trembling is getting worse, it would be wise to just have it checked. And you may need new brakes because of that. Not that they're worn out.
Stand off the rust.
Yeah, no, not really. Brake rotors used to be built thicker and heavier than they used to be, and they were machinable, and you could clean them up and reuse them. But we find now that they're so marginal to begin with that there's not much machining available in them. But that's what you've got happening there. It's not uncommon at all.
Okay. That's sad because the car is going to be rusted out and dead with only 26,000 on it.
Well, I don't think the car itself, is going to be a rust issue. Those Subarus have gotten pretty good for rust protection, but those brakes are prone because they're raw cast iron exposed to the elements. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks, Diane. We appreciate the call. And over to Rich in Wilton. Rich, you're on with Gordon Friggy.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. 2004 GMC 1500 4x4. I've done brakes, front rotors included. Did brakes on the rear, everything. It's four-wheel disc. Did brakes all the way around. Did all the brake lines on the back, calipers. Now I'm coming to a stop. Just before I come to the complete stop, ABS kicks in.
Yeah,
the ABS kicks in.
Now, the warning light works when I do a startup, but when the ABS activates, I don't get any kind of a light, and I've got no codes.
Yeah. Yep. Very common. Very frustrating, but here's what's happening. The front ABS wheel speed sensors are in the front wheel bearing assemblies. They're called hub assemblies. And that sensor pokes down in there and reads a tone ring or a wheel that flashes by. What happens to those vehicles, not just your GMC, but it's very common on all hub-bearing vehicles, the rust starts to strangle the sensor. The rust expansion of the rust starts to strangle that sensor.
When I had the pads replaced on the front, they were literally metal to metal. And I was thinking maybe metal shavings or something are plugging the sensor?
No, they can't get in there because your sensor's in the hub. But the sensor's getting pulled.
Hello? You still there?
Are you there?
Are you there? We're here.
Can you hear me, Rich?
Hello?
I guess we lost Rich. All right, Rich, you'll have to listen on the radio. Anyway, finish up.
So anyway, what Rich is having happen there is quite common. And due to the age of that vehicle, I think it would be difficult to to change the sensors, clean the hubs, and put them all back together. The more traditional or routine thing today is to replace the wheel bearing hub assembly, which comes with a new sensor incorporated in it. But the question is, which one is it? It's probably not both of them.
So the code wouldn't tell you which one?
There may or may not be a code. And I always scan them first to see if there's any history codes, because there may be not any current codes, but it'll say, it'll sense there was an issue with left or right front. It's usually always the front.
Yeah.
And that's the one to go to. But a shop with the right equipment can watch the wheel speeds while driving the vehicle at that speed and watch to see if one of those sensors starts to drop out of the picture.
That's funny. When I had a problem with one of my cars, and the sensor light, the ABS light, would go on only when it was very wet out. Like maybe I would plow through a puddle or something like that.
Yeah. That's not uncommon. You probably had a marginal connection somewhere that was influenced by the water.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to line 5 and Susan in Rutland County. Susan, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 2015 cross-country Volvo, 40,000 miles. I just took it in. At around 10,000 miles, I started having trouble with my dashboard illumination. And if normally you would rate it from 1 to 10, it goes from a 10 down to a 2, so it's barely perceptible.
Mm-hmm.
And I know on the left, there's that little gadget you can scroll up and down, and that has no effect on it. So I told the dealership because it kind of concerned me. And then it happened again at 20,000 and then at 30,000. So it's happened about 5 times in the winter and in the summer. And every time I bring it into the dealership, they do that diagnostic code, and they can't find anything. What concerns me is I have 10,000 miles left on my warranty, and I said to them, what happens when the whole car goes at 70 or 80,000?
You got a point.
And so they said they can't you know, as far as they're concerned, this isn't happening.
Right. They can't reproduce the problem is what they're saying. Yeah. One interesting thing about your question, and I've encountered this before. Your Volvo has automatic headlights, correct?
Yes, I have them set to automatic, so I don't have to think about it.
Okay. Do two things. Either turn them on and off manually instead of them having in the automatic mode.
Okay.
Or when the dash lights are too dim to look at, or too dim for you, switch the headlights. Change the position of the headlight switch and see if they brighten up, because If you're out in the daylight, the instrument lights are come on max brightness, and then at night they dim down because you don't need that intensity.
Okay.
And I've had in on older vehicles, I've had people mistakenly turn the dimmer all the way down, and at night they can read them, but in daytime they can't. Are you having the problem at night or in the daytime?
It's happened both. We had to drive home from New Jersey up the Thruway and all the way up to Vermont with this happening. And my husband was with me, and I was just really, really nervous that we'd lose our headlights.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to affect your headlights, but if and when it happens again, go to the headlight switch and change its position. You know, turn it on manually instead of on automatic, or turn it off if it's daytime.
Okay.
And if you immediately see that they respond, get that information to the dealer and tell them this is how it worked and this is what happened.
Okay.
But the earlier part of your question is you're worried about what happens when the warranty's completely gone.
Yeah.
Contact Volvo.
Okay.
And just directly. You can look at the number in your owner's manual. And just say, you know, you're not really complaining at the moment about the dealer or about what's going on, but you're concerned that this will fail and the warranty's going to be off.
You want a paper trail.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a car that's got to go at least 300,000 here, so.
Yeah. That's what I would do then.
Susan, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much. Bye.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Over to Kathy in Seward, New York. Kathy, you're on. Goodbye, Kathy. Sorry you waited all that time for nothing. Let's go to Josh in Lake George. Josh.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I was just calling in. I was listening to Linda with her gas tank issue.
Yeah.
One problem I've noticed on Subarus, there's a charcoal canister basically allows the gas tank to purge the air that's in it, and that valve can get stuck closed. That's what I'm aware of, and it'll cause the gas tank not filling prematurely.
Yeah, did you catch that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. All cars have that. It's a valve that allows the air to come out when the gasoline goes in. But I thought that she was saying she felt as though it was really full.
No, it was coming out.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it was totally full.
I thought she was saying that it was spitting gasoline out. Yeah, yeah. So that's why I didn't go there with the vent.
Josh, thanks a lot for the call. Over to Guy in Red Hook. Guy, you're on.
Hi, thanks, Ray, for taking my call.
Sure.
Gordon, I heard on a previous show that you had trained in Germany.
Yes.
And are familiar with the Bosch electronic fuel injection system.
Yeah.
I've got a 1978 Datsun 280Z that was made early in the year. Apparently, they switched computers later in the year in that car. The car runs well when I initially start it, and then if I put my hand on the over the thermostat, I feel the hot water start to go through the thermostat, and when that water starts to go through and warm it up, it starts to run rough, and then it stalls. And I've checked about everything I could think of. I've switched out the sensor that is on the engine that senses the hot water.
Yeah, the coolant temp sensor. Yeah.
So the question is, do you think I need to replace that computer?
No, I doubt it. That's usually the last thing that ever was a problem. It's a 1978, you said.
Yes.
Okay, so there's no oxygen sensor on that system that I'm aware of.
I don't think so.
No, they didn't bring them on mandatorily until 1981. So there's a cold start system that, like you said, senses the temperature of the coolant, and it makes adjustments to the injection system as the engine warms. Changing the sensor was definitely a good thought, but without diagnosing other things of that system, it's too complicated to lead you to any one area because of that. You know, there's a lot of things that happens from cold start to warm up. It's called mapped. It's a mapped system. It's all predetermined mixtures, which the newer systems are much better because they tailor the engine management to everything: incoming air, ambient temperature, coolant temp, everything. So I don't know. I can't lead you into any one direction. You always want to check for vacuum leaks, air leaks. If that system has an airflow sensor or an airflow meter, everything's got to be tight around it because it's measuring every drop of air that the engine wants.
All right, well, we'll have to leave it there. Guy, thanks for the call, and we're just about out of time. Gordon, here's one that came in, and we'll take care of an email very quickly. This is from Ryan. I just bought a 2002 Nissan Frontier 4-cylinder, 5-speed rear-wheel drive with 260,000 miles on it. Bought it to run between the hardware store and his house. Are there, besides routine maintenance, things I should do to baby this car to squeeze as many miles out of it as I can? That's from Ryan. 260K, he bought it.
Yeah, they're good vehicles. Oil changes. I can't stress it enough because we don't change oil often enough. We're led to believe it can go longer by the manufacturer, by EPA pressures on the car makers, and then you get sludged up engines and issues. So don't relax on the maintenance because it's old and high mileage.
How many more miles are you going to get out of it?
Oh,
you
yeah.
take it to the moon three times?
Let's measure it in trips to the hardware store.
All right, fair enough. All right, you make a point. And on that brilliant bit of wisdom, we'll say goodbye to you for today's program. Gordon Fricke, thanks for being here. Support comes from College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts. For over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing. Full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Rembrandt, the consummate etcher, and other 17th-century printmakers. More on Facebook and ArkellMuseum.org. John Lee & Company, offering estate liquidations, house sales, appraisals, clean-out, and auction services for over 40 years. purchasing jewelry, art, gold, paintings, Asian, ethnographic, and antiques, JonLeeAuctions.com. And the Ashokan Center presenting Alasdair Fraser and Natalie Haas in concert of traditional and contemporary Scottish fiddle and cello music on Sunday, May 1st at 3 p.m., ashokencenter.org. Thanks again to Gordon Fricke for all the brilliant answers to all of your questions, and thanks for calling with the questions. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. Deb Malik took your calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, the week is already blowing by. It's a Food Friday. Stay tuned now for news.